troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, how you doing over there? Are you surviving?
Surviving is a great way to put it. Having a good time in the country and keeping my head down.
Yeah, I think you've convinced me to get out of the city.
I think everybody is kind of in the same boat. Right now it's really nice and quiet, and you never know, the rest of the world is going a little bit cuckoo, but that's good. You know, I'm glad people are driving for some important change. So more power to them, and I'm glad they're doing it. Just I wish that the violence that came along with it would calm down, because it takes away from the important messages that are there.
It's a very good point. And I think until that changes, I'm going to move out and buy a farm and start growing my own food. Anyways, but let's jump into the stories that we're going to talk about today. Try to shift our focus from the unfortunate events of the day. So first up, two major studies showing that the drug hydroxychloroquine is ineffective against COVID-19 have been retracted. So we're going to get into what the science says. What does this mean about the drug, and what does it say about the peer review process? And then the UK newspaper, The Guardian, was paid over $800,000 to publish a series of articles attacking factory farming. I feel like we keep coming back to this, Kevin, but people keep going after it, so we have to talk about it. So we're going to get into the claims in the article, and then we're going to talk a little bit about conflict of interest, because this seems to be one. And then next up, has coronavirus killed consumer interest in junk science and fad diets? It looks like it for now, but is it a temporary change or is it permanent? We're going to dive into that. And then finally, researchers have uncovered a new skinny gene, quote unquote, that keeps some people thin no matter how much they eat and how little they exercise. And so this could be a target for effective obesity treatments. So we'll see if there's anything to that. But first up, Kevin.
Skinny gene, not skinny jeans.
Ba-dum-bum. Kevin's already firing the puns, so I got to catch up.
All right.
Anyways, all right. So tell us about these retractions of these. Well, first of all, what is hydroxychloroquine, in case people don't know? And then let's talk about the retractions.
Well, hydroxychloroquine, it's really interesting that this has become such a touchstone in the recent months because of its alleged activity against, it's hypothesized activity against SARS-CoV-2. Hydroxychloroquine has been an anti-malarial drug for a long time. We're going back probably 50 years, if not more. And it's very well, chloroquine is the original drug. Hydroxychloroquine is a slightly decorated version of chloroquine. And all very safe over the years, been shown to be safe, been shown to be well tolerated, been widely prescribed for huge numbers of folks with malaria. And this has been something that has been, you know, it's not a unusual drug. It's cheap. It's available. It's generally considered safe. So physicians have known about this for a long time. The problem is that now this has been politicized and even touted as a potential cure for SARS-CoV-2 or a therapy for SARS-CoV-2 because it kills the virus in a petri dish. And as we know, a lot of times you see very promising results from a petri dish that don't translate to the whole organism. If you take it and it's not taken up in the system, it not bioavailable, as they say, it has zero opportunity to affect the virus where the virus lives. So we know a lot about hydroxychloroquine. We know a lot about it over the years. But now the question is, can we make good decisions about this when everybody's trying to publish fast and furious and in the middle of a pandemic? And can we trust what's coming out in preprint servers?
So the two studies that we're talking about, one was published in The Lancet, which is a big medical journal, and then the other one is the New England Journal of Medicine. So these are both reputable journals, and the studies, I believe, showed that not only was hydroxychloroquine ineffective, but people actually were a little bit more likely to die from COVID-19 if they took it. And then it's come out that there's, well, I don't know if it's been completely confirmed, but there's been some suggestions that the data that these are based on is just not not reasonable or not reliable. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the Lancet study, they looked at 96,000 patients, and they noted if you were receiving HC, hydroxychloroquine, if they were getting that or some derivation of it, they said that they were people were almost twice as likely to die from COVID-19. And that didn't seem quite right or consistent with what other studies have shown, which has predominantly been no effect or maybe a slightly negative effect, but you're looking in a compromised population. So you're looking in a population of people who, because of comorbidities and other issues, only the sickest people were receiving the drug in many cases. So these weren't randomized studies. These were just people who were receiving it. How did they do? And there are a lot of questions raised about this particular study by people who looked at it carefully, is that they claim that there are some huge number of data from Africa, yet Africa has been very, the nations of the African continent are very guarded with their data and have not released much data. So it seemed implausible. And this plus other issues with respect to not being a randomized control study, the fact that they got some things wrong, like one hospital reporting in Asia was actually built into the Australia numbers. There's a whole lot of different reasons that people would look at this skeptically. And this was a report that said it changed that by the addition of hydroxychloroquine, you doubled your incidence of death upon COVID-19 infection.
Okay, so probably an exaggerated conclusion. And just a few other things that I saw, and I have to give credit to David Gorski. He's a physician and a science writer, and he talks a lot about the anti-vaccine movement. But he pointed out that the study reported more deaths for Australia than the actual country of Australia reported.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, you alluded to that just now. But so that's a big red flag. But then another point is that they would this company that provided the data, I think they're called Surgisphere, if I'm pronouncing that right, but they would have had to have relationships with like close to 600 hospitals all over the United States in order to produce this data, which is unlikely to say the least, because I guess they're a tiny little company. They have 6 or 11 employees, no statisticians, you know, very few people that would have been capable of producing this. And so they came up with these numbers, and it seems that everybody ran with them without giving it much thought. Is that what happened? Or, I mean, what happened here, Kevin? You're the scientist. You've published articles.
The other big devil in the details is that they also did a lot of adjustment of the data they had. So they said that they normalized data for age and sex and how sick patients were. And so they're starting to add other levels of transformation of the data, because many of the hypothesis of, well, if only the sickest people are receiving hydroxychloroquine, it would follow that you would see an association of higher morbidity with people who took it, not necessarily because of the drug, but because they were sicker. And so they tried to control for this. But what does that mean? And so a lot of this is in the statistical details. Really, the bottom line of all of this is that you have to be very careful on how you interpret these things, especially when this particular topic has been so politicized. And then when the president comes out and says, you know, I take hydroxychloroquine to, avoid the virus. After he said that, you couldn't buy the stuff. And so there are very important factors that are going into the interpretations of these studies. And really what we need is more long-term study, more reproducible studies, and not just kind of gluing together data that you're able to obtain from analyzing a cohort that is already infected.
So would you say, and again, this is a little speculative, so feel free to say you don't know, but does it seem like the scientific community was trying to push back against statements that politicians were making and that the press was making that weren't justified? And maybe that's why a study like this didn't catch people's attention. And Gorski, again, he actually apologized. He said, I should have caught this when I was reviewing this article. And it looks really scammy now that I review all these oddities in it. So do you think there was a rush to kind of counteract what scientists saw as misinformation, and that's why this just wasn't flagged?
Well, I think that physicians are fed up with this because hydroxychloroquine has been prescribed for ages, and all of a sudden it becomes this hot potato of medicine, and people saying it's more dangerous, it's not dangerous, it works, it doesn't work, and we don't know. And there's not enough consistent data from careful studies. It also seems like a lot of people are kind of and I don't know this for a fact because I haven't looked at the background of all the different groups that have been doing the work, but it seems like an easy way to dip your toe into a popular question to analyze the data and present your results. And I think that the bottom line is we just need more time and more studies on these things. And most of what we've seen around hydroxychloroquine, from what we've seen at this point, there's no effect. And I think that's the best outcome we can glean. That's exactly what they showed when they tried to use it with Ebola. I mean, it just didn't work. And that's fine. Like I mentioned before, in vivo does not match what happens in a Petri dish.
And there was just, we should mention, there was another study published in the New England Journal of Medicine based on a different data set that found more or less the same thing, that the drug doesn't work for COVID-19. But are you concerned that, you know, an outcome like this gives fuel to the anti-science groups and it gives fuel to people who say you can't trust mainstream medicine because they call you stupid and they call you anti-science? But then they make these ridiculous mistakes. Can you speak to that as a, you know, an expert on science communication, Kevin?
No, absolutely. It erodes the trust in science. When people see we're in the middle of a pandemic, a therapeutic would be extremely helpful because vaccines can't come fast enough. And people are hearing, yes, it works. No, it doesn't work. This study's a fraud. This study's not a fraud. This study has some questions about the data. This one doesn't. When nobody has any cohesive, cogent information to base their conclusion, they basically throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, we can't believe any of it. You know, we don't know what to believe. And that leaves the door open for the second tier, where the internet or politicians or whatever can now have more influence than the scientific literature. And that's where this becomes a problem.
All right. Well, maybe we just need to say, I don't know, a little bit more, or maybe emphasize it more when we're talking to the media, or I guess scientists. I don't mean me because I'm technically part of the media, so it's not my role. But is that what I'm hearing you say, that we just need to go, look, we're working on it. I don't want to say anything more than I can say right now.
Well, and that's a hard thing for people to say for some reason. I don't get it. I love that answer of, look, we don't know. But right now the public wants answers. And for scientists to say, hey, look, we're in the middle of this, we're getting it done, we will tell you soon, isn't a good enough answer for most people, and especially politicians. And so the problem is that we've seen examples of where studies that are underway that are more comprehensive have actually ended because of answers that have come out from these early kind of cursory works. And but to your point, what you just said, it was actually the last line of the article that was really good. It said, being honest about what we know and what we don't will serve us well. And I agree 1,000%.
Very good. Well, speaking of things that we know a little bit more about, that being factory farming, let's talk about this article in The Guardian, Kevin. And I don't know about you, but I'm not crazy about The Guardian science coverage, especially in the last couple of years. But this is from friends of ours, Henry Miller and Rob Wager, both biologists who are talking about this newspaper getting paid by an animal rights group to run articles attacking what they call factory farming. So, so much to say on this, but what's your initial take on what they did here?
Well, what they're covering is actually something that's been known for a little while now, but really is important to reiterate. It really shows the blurred line between reporting news and advertisement. Because here's a case where the Open Philanthropy Project, they paid the British Guardian, The Guardian, almost $900,000 to run a series of articles called Animals Farmed. And the idea was to put out disparaging articles about animal agriculture and maybe even some other stuff that would really attempt to change public perception of what animal agriculture is. And, you know, here the paper is getting this $900,000 donation or grant or whatever it was, a grant of $900,000 to follow certain kinds of stories. And it really starts to question how objective media is if they're being paid to produce the content they're producing.
One thing that is really rich about the whole situation is that The Guardian is so sanctimonious. And this quote is on their website. And well, I'm not going to read the exact quote, but more or less they say, you know, we're independent journalists and we're not beholden to commercial or ideological interests. And so we can say what we want. And so I really wonder how their editorial team deals with hypocrisy like this. Do they just, it doesn't apply to them because they're good people and they care about the truth. And so they can take money and no one else can. I don't understand how they justify it, but it's just so blatant.
Well, that's the dissonance, right? They feel as though they're independent. And so with independence comes objectivity, and that it doesn't matter that they're paying for us to have a few more reporters to cover these stories. We're going to cover them fairly. The problem is they don't cover them fairly. And when you look at The Guardian and its coverage of questions in agriculture in general, you see a very strong skewing. And maybe it was December 2018 when they published an article by Erin Brockovich. Remember this one?
I do, sadly.
Yeah. So she publishes an article saying that, you know, glyphosate is in all your food and giving you cancer. And she's, you know, talked about how people spray it on carrots and beets and quinoa, as she mentioned. And of course, if you sprayed glyphosate on any of those things, it would die. Glyphosate being the herbicide in Roundup. And yet, you know, this very scathing, fact-free romp about glyphosate in agriculture, it was horrible, horrible, horrible article. Yet it was very strong because it came from somebody who has a generally favorable public perception, thanks to the movie Erin Brockovich. The funny part is that she never shows anywhere in the article that she was on the environmental consulting board for Whites and Luxembourg, who is the one of the Europe's biggest law firms that is litigating against glyphosate. So essentially, she was out there as a recruiter without saying she was recruiting, using the mouthpiece of The Guardian to recruit a class to essentially sue for damages around a relatively safe agricultural chemical.
And they've done other things too. I mean, they've given a consistent platform to Carrie Gillum at US Right to Know, who has peddled similar misinformation about glyphosate. And we've documented that at GLP pretty thoroughly. And of course, US Right to Know takes money from the organic food industry. So you have another example there. But specific to this article, there's a gentleman that works for this Open Philanthropy Project. That is pretty challenging, huh? But he used to work for the Humane Society, which is a major animal rights group. And I believe OPP is also an investor in Impossible Foods, which makes plant-based meat. And so you have just a a cornucopia, if you will, of conflicts here. And I again, inherently, it's not wrong to have an interest in an issue, but I think to your point earlier that you're not covering it fairly. So what's up? I don't know what else we can say, frankly.
Well, it just goes down to the idea that if you're going to finance articles that have a very strong lack of objectivity, and this is the difference that maybe you can speak to as a journalist, is that in a normal article, you would have a discussion of the issue and multiple frames of reference from credible sources. These are a single frame of reference from a confirmed bias source. And so this is where this is very dangerous, because it masquerades as news and yet is very against what we understand as the factual basis of information. Like they talked about the ractopamine, which is a feed additive that is rarely used and certainly not used in certain things. You know, like, and the good example here is Canadian pork, never been used in Canadian exported pork. Yet the Guardian had a whole article about it. You know, it's this kind of misinformation without any kind of good rebuttal, which shows how far that $900,000 goes.
And they also made some claims about the impact on climate change from animal agriculture. And I believe it was last year, but the EPA put out a big report and they said that animal agriculture specifically is responsible for, I believe it's like 5 or 6% of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And I've seen experts like Allison Van Enenum, and I think his name's Frank Mitlohner at UC yeah. Davis. They, you know, they've put out, they've amplified this data from the EPA, but they've also pointed out other flaws in the arguments that are leveled at animal agriculture. And so there's no discussion of that in the Guardian piece. And to your question about, you know, objectivity in journalism, there was none of that. You know, they didn't talk to the two people I just mentioned or any other expert. And, you know, like over at GLP, we consistently come down in favor of the mainstream science on just about every issue. But even when, you know, we're attacking somebody, or at least attacking their arguments, I always reach out to them. I've emailed Non-GMO Project dozens of times. I've been in contact with USRTK. They never want to talk to you except to call you a jerk, you know? And so there's not much you can do in that case, but you always have to try at least to say, hey, you know, I want to present the facts, and I just don't see them doing that.
Well, to be able to say we reached out to so-and-so and they declined to comment is an important thing to have in every article when you're seeking additional information. And it's not, you know, the flawed both sides argument where, well, we talk to someone who says genetic engineering is a safe and useful technology, and so we talk to someone from the other side. It's not that false equivalence question. It's a question of when you have an issue of controversy where there is good dialogue to be had, that you need to have that information so that the reader can look on further. But in this case, The Guardian is very one-sided with very relatively skewed and biased information.
Yeah, and just in closing, they don't even do the false balance thing anymore. It's just falsehood after falsehood after falsehood, and there's no balance to it at all, you know? So it's actually getting worse. But I think, you know, moving on.
It's a false imbalance.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's a phrase for a technical term for it. I don't know if it exists, but that's perfect what it is. But yeah, moving on to our next story, I'm hoping that the kind of journalism in quotes that we're seeing from places like The Guardian aren't as effective. And this is a story from Cam Dahl at Real Agriculture, and he's talking about how the coronavirus pandemic has sort of shifted people's concerns, and they're more interested in what academics like you, Kevin, are saying, and less interested in what Gwyneth Paltrow says. So what's your take on this story?
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, but I really thought this back in February, and when March came along and we started to see the specter of this pandemic starting to manifest, I thought, all right, now we're going to see a reliance on good science and scientists, and I'll be cool again, you know? And I think I've been rather disappointed in that. But the article is by Cam Dahl, from president of Cereals Canada. And he's had his finger on the pulse of a couple of things that maybe gave him certain optimism. And one of the things he says, for example, the anti-gluten movement really has disappeared, and that it's kind of not just disappeared in terms of the noise they made, but he actually says people are going after bread again. And there's been a big bump in flour demand across Canada, and that this seems to be a really good thing. And then I started to think of, what's bread in Spanish?
I don't know.
pan, P-A-N, right? So the pandemic, it actually means in Latin, it means we're covered in bread. So it kind of makes sense. But this has been the big deal, is that people have generally started to change their views, maybe because of a couple of other cultural things that have happened, is that for many people, it was the first time they went to a grocery store in their lives and saw bare shelves, or the first time they couldn't buy a roll of toilet paper, or the first time they sensed maybe a little bit of fragility in the food system. And with that, maybe felt a little bit better about starting to trust the science that gave us so much. And that was kind of his opening salvo in the article.
Something that worries me, and we've talked about this in the context of vaccines before, is that food producers and home goods producers, they responded pretty well to this pandemic. So there were a couple of hiccups in the supply chain. There were some shortages. I think they're still ongoing in terms of meat. But they recovered pretty well, you know. So at least here in California, if you go to any grocery store or convenience store, they're fully stocked on toilet paper again. And I can still buy meat at the local grocery store. It's a little pricier than normal. But the point I'm making is that because the system still worked, I'm concerned that people are going to fall back to their old positions because they didn't really experience a lot of pain. And oftentimes that's what it takes to move people off an irrational point of view, is they have to see, or they really experience the impact of what they think before they will change their minds. And I don't think that has happened yet. I don't want that to happen, of course. I want people to suffer. But sometimes it seems like that's what it's going to take before you really permanently put a dent in this sort of this woo-filled anti-science movement that seems to never go away.
Well, he mentions that Canadians maybe feel a little different about this, and that there's been a little bit more distance between this kind of nostalgia food movement, like, well, let's go back and do it the way we used to, and, you know, throw away the chemistry and throw away the pesticides, and let's move away from precision ag. Let's, you know, go back to the way we did it before. And most people who say that, they never did it before. So, you know, the good day. But the other part is, when you're in Canada, you have relatively limited agricultural land and very few people. And you're also in a climate where you only have, and I don't remember what it is now, but a very limited production window. You can only produce food in Canada for a couple of months a year. So it really is a question of exploiting this very narrow window that has environmental hazards on either side. I mean, this last year they had snow into the production season that was really damaging. So Canada might be a little bit different because they understand the scarcity a little different, and they may be a little more open to, which sounds strange coming from the land of David Suzuki and other things. They may be a little more open to new innovation around agriculture.
Well, hopefully, you know, I don't know how it compares to here, but the thing you hear talked about in the U.S. is that you have sort of like these different cultures, really, along the coasts in these major cities. You have people that are very affluent, but they have no awareness of food or agriculture. They don't even know that much science. They think they are pro-science on a set number of issues, but they're sort of disconnected from the middle of the country that makes all their food. So it sounds like Canada is different than that. I honestly don't know. It's just not a subject I'm familiar with.
Probably pretty much the same. I think you have a lot of big producers throughout Manitoba and Saskatchewan who are really the breadbasket of Canada and the oil basket and the pulse basket, the meat basket. What else do you put in a basket? But you know, those are huge production areas. The horticultural areas of Ontario are extremely prolific for specialty crop production. Those areas really contrast against the cities like Vancouver and Toronto. And when you look at where the majority of the populations are in Canada, you know, they're not out in Saskatoon and Regina. They're Vancouver and Toronto and other big cities that are much more like the coastal U.S. And so many big decisions come from those cities that really affect entire provinces, especially with respect to farm inputs. So Canada's a cool place. I appreciate the farmers up there a lot, visited there a lot over the course of my career, but they always lament upon two different Canadas, the ones in the city and the ones out in the prairies.
Well, I guess we'll just keep our fingers crossed and hope that the slight changes we're seeing will be permanent, or maybe they will facilitate more changes in the near future. But let's talk about not being fat, Kevin. I think everyone is pro this next topic. So, and you being the geneticist, you got to lead us here. But so we're talking about a thinness gene that could offer genetically engineered weight control. And this is from SciTech Daily. So what's going on here? This sounds really promising.
Yeah, definitely a gene that I know I don't have. you know, my family has some very specific weight trends that I've been, you know, if I'm not eating right and exercising, I got to buy new pants. So this is a really cool story because this is a gene that's been understood for a while in some capacities that always was associated with cancer. And what they did was look at data from something like 47,000 people in Estonia, which as growing up as a kid, I thought that was a place in the Flintstones, that they looked at the data and found an association between the thin people who were having no question about weight gain, never worried about weight gain, and connecting them, they all shared the same common gene variant. So when you looked at the data from 47,000 people, looked at very thin people, they had tended to have this strong association with this gene variant. So it turns out that this is that these are folks who can eat anything and just never put on weight. And we all know people like that.
I hate all of you, by the way. I hate you.
Jerks. The gene is called ALK, and it's a gene that has been implicated in different types of cancers. It's a gene that's active in the brain. It seems to be most expressed in the brain. So maybe it has something to do with either producing some sort of a signal or some sort of modifying a behavior maybe around eating. I don't know that for sure. But what they do know is they did the gold standard test. It's one thing to identify a genetic association. Here's the gene that's present in all these people, and here's the behavior or the phenotype or the trait that they show, in this case, thinness. So now what they did was they knocked that gene out of flies and knocked that gene out of mice. And they found that mice and flies that had the gene knocked out were thinner. And I don't know how you have a thinner fly. I've never really, you know, see that morbidly obese one walking across the countertop, just flitting its wings as hard as it can, and it just can't do it. But this is a case where you knock out this gene and you see them not grapple with the same type of weight issues. And so that was a very, very strong evidence. So the good news about this and why it matters is because we know what the gene is and we know what the gene encodes and what its protein product is. And because it's been associated with cancer, they've made a series of drugs that are inhibitors of ALK. So genes that are proteins or drugs that either are binding to it or decreasing its expression. And so this is where I really wanted to dig in a little bit more, but I'll do that more in the future. But really the idea is that it could be something that we could target with a drug. And if rather than eliminating it genetically, which you can't really do, you could potentially inhibit the product. And that could give people another therapy to help them lose weight.
So would they just do a clinical trial of sorts where they take people that are obese and they give some people the one of these drugs, one of these ALK inhibitors, and then they have the other as a control group and just see what impact it has? Is that the way they would do it? Is that ethical, given that it's a cancer drug?
Well, sure. I think it probably would be a very reasonable study. And you could see why they wouldn't just see this in cancer patients, mm-hmm. because so much of either cancer itself or the therapies for cancer have results in our tendency to eat, appetite, flavor of food, all these things. So no one's ever really looked at a pure population of people who have trouble with weight gain and tested them on these kinds of drugs, at least not that I'm aware of. So this is exactly what you would do, especially if these drugs have already been shown to be safe. Now the question is efficacy towards this endpoint or towards this indication, in this case, obesity. And so it could be something that we see in the very near future.
You know, I really hope so, because like you said, if I don't count calories and watch my sugar intake and make sure that I'm once the gym opens back up that I'm lifting weights, then I just put on weight. Like, you know, I eat like one Hot Pocket and I gain 50 pounds. And so I'm tired of that. So maybe, maybe I could just take a pill and not have to worry about that. So anyways, but what's up with talking biotech, Kevin?
Well, a lot of fun stuff. It starts our sixth year, five complete years of Talking Biotech podcast, and that feels really good. The ones that are coming up, I should have Rob Fraley on, who is one of the original people who genetically engineered a plant, the former chief scientific officer of Monsanto Company. Also had a very good interview about the conservation opportunities with gene editing. Can we use the gene editing tools that have been developed for one thing to do something else? And that is monitor specific types of animals in a population. And in this case, endangered fish. Can you come up with ways to use these tools as very sensitive ways to test who's in your population? And very fascinating stuff coming up in the next few weeks.
Yeah, definitely check it out, talkingbiotechpodcast.com. And he is at Kevin Foltz on Twitter. I am at Cam J English. We are on Spotify. We're on iTunes. We're also at geneticliteracyproject.org. You guys are amazing. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.